Welcome to the Arlington Street Church podcast. Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
Last week, just in time for Earth Day, ABC News announced cheerfully, here are three simple things you can do to help combat global warming. Number one, plant trees and other greenery. Number two, reduce food waste, such as by starting a backyard compost pile, if you have a backyard. Number three, conserve energy, such as by purchasing Energy Star rated appliances, if you have enough money to purchase an appliance. Now, all of these are good things to do. They are. But the list is as noteworthy for what it omits as for what it contains. There's no mention of the role of corporations or of the governments they spend millions of dollars to influence. There's no hint of the power of collective action to move us toward environmental justice. Instead, we're told once again, it's our personal choices that are responsible for the climate crisis and can solve the climate crisis, which is precisely what corporations and governments want us to think, so we'll blame ourselves instead of them. Corporations like Disney Entertainment, which owns, ABC News. Some of us are old enough to remember 50 simple things you can do to save the Earth, published 35 years ago. This best-selling Bible of personal responsibility not only urged us to plant trees, start compost piles, and conserve energy, but also offered simple thing number two, snap six-pack rings. Remember those? And number 29, recycle newspapers. Remember those? In 1989, when 50 Simple Things was published, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 353 parts per million. Today, it's 425 parts per million, an increase of more than 20%. Now, it's true, if everyone had done all 50 things, we'd have knocked climate change back on its heels by now. But we didn't, and it doesn't look like we're going to anytime soon. So instead of making me feel hopeful, ABC's three simple things stirred in me a feeling of hopelessness. Need I recite the parade of horribles marching raucously behind our relentlessly warming climate? Or have we all memorized it by now? Heat waves, drought, famine, mass extinction, global economic and social collapse. You know the drill. We have broken faith with our beloved planet. We have breached the primordial covenant that the earth would sustain us provided we did not take too much or fail to reciprocate our taking with giving back. Now, we face the inescapable consequence of our transgression, the withdrawal of sustenance and protection. It's not surprising that some of us have abandoned hope. What has surprised me has been the emergence of an active campaign against hope. Some of our most thoughtful activists have concluded that hope is a dangerous distraction from the work that must be done. Hopium, they call it. Storyteller and palliative caregiver Stephen Jenkinson calls hope the four-letter word for people who are unwilling to know things for what they are. Our time, he says, requires us to be hope-free. Talitha Amadea Aho, a young pediatric trauma chaplain, scoffs that young millennials will flee any old fogey peddling hope. She claims to find all the motivation she needs in hopelessness. Disparagement of hope has penetrated the academy in his influential 2017 book, Embracing Hopelessness. Eminent theologian Miguel de la Torre denounces hope as an illusion maintaining oppressive structures. The first step toward liberation, he insists, requires the crucifixion of hope. Many people cannot afford to be hopeful, agrees Jörg Rieger of Vanderbilt University, because of the challenging realities of life on planet Earth. Without this embrace of hopelessness, adds Catherine Keller of Drew Theological School, our best aspirations turn to fatuous comfort, virtuous self-delusion, toxic benevolence. In these desperate days, hope is on the ropes. And yet, the most influential moral voice of my lifetime has been Martin Luther King Jr. In 1963, when I was 10 years old, my white suburban innocence was shattered by what I saw on our black and white TV. Horrifying news footage of children in Birmingham, Alabama, some scarcely older than I, set upon by police dogs, knocked down by fire hoses, exposing as an obscene lie my daily patriotic recitation of liberty and justice for all. Something was wrong, deeply wrong, in my beloved country. I resolved to find out what it was and to do what I could to make it right. Today, the words Dr. King spoke just 2 months before his assassination echo in my mind. We must accept finite disappointment, Dr. King said, but never lose infinite hope. If Dr. King was right, how do we hold on to infinite hope amid so much crushing disappointment? First, we have to untether hope from optimism. Václav Havel, first president of the Czech Republic, was very clear about this. Hope, he declared, is an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. It is this hope above all that gives us the strength to live. Rebecca Solnit, who has studied human behavior in the maw of disaster, explains that hope just means another world might be possible. Not promised, not guaranteed. Hope, Solnit says, calls for action, and action is impossible without hope. According to Buddhist teacher Joanna Macy, active hope is a practice like Tai Chi or gardening. It's something we do rather than have. First, we take a clear view of reality. She doesn't say a rose-colored cartoon, pie-in-the-sky view. She says a clear view of reality. Second, we identify what we hope for. And third, we take action to move ourselves in that direction. Far from a luxury enjoyed by the comfortable and the cosseted, the privileged and the protected, hope has historically been the lifeblood of the discarded and the dispossessed. studying the spiritual sung by the enslaved black liberation theologian James Cone, identified hope for the kingdom of heaven to come in those spirituals. But even in the worldly and agnostic blues, he found enduring hope. The blues, Cone proclaimed, are about black life and the sheer earth and gut capacity to survive in an extreme situation of oppression. Singing the blues, Cone said, black people affirmed an authentic hope in the essential worth of black humanity. The better day of which they sang expressed not naive optimism that things would get better, but simply the will to be. In his book, Keep Going, The Art of Perseverance, Lakota historian and storyteller Joseph E. Marshall III writes, hope is one of the sparks by which life sustains itself. Hope is most often the companion of the downtrodden. It dwells in the hearts and minds of those who have experienced loss or tragedy, or anyone whose road seems more uphill than level. There are no guarantees that hope will bring the desired outcome. But if we do not or cannot hope, we have empowered the cause of our difficulty. Cling to hope, Marshall exhorts us, no matter what happens. When I spoke last week with forest ecologist Dan Wells about the challenge of hope, he raised his arm and pointed silently to the walls of his apartment, which display huge, color-drenched, museum-quality prints of the primeval redwood forest, images Dan had photographed himself. In his wordless gesture, I heard, hope abides here. In the ancient forest, in the more than human, redwoods do not trouble themselves about hope or despair. From seed and sapling to death, decay, and rebirth, redwoods endure. Redwoods are. Dan's silent signal was so simple, so confident, so powerful. It evoked for me Gautama Buddha touching the earth as his witness against Mara, the demonic embodiment of doubt and fear. My colleague, Margaret Bullitt Jonas, missioner for creation care of the Episcopal Diocese of Western Massachusetts, asks a trenchant question. What happens in your body when you don't feel hope? Here is Margaret's answer. If you're like me, you contract. When I go into a hopeless place about the climate crisis, I feel small, helpless, alone. There's nothing I can do, nothing to be done. It's all going to hell, and I might as well quit trying to change that. Might as well curl up in a ball of anxiety and despair, or distract and numb myself, maybe with entertainment, a drink, shopping, something. Hope, Margaret says, feels different in the body. Hope expands us, it connects us, it moves us out of withdrawal into engagement, out of isolation into relationship. When we're in a hopeful place, we find energy and courage to act. We know that what we do matters. Margaret invites each of us to name our own ultimate hope and what each of us wants to embody in our own lives. This is a potent exercise that's worth some time this morning, so I invite you to get comfortable, but not too comfortable, and maybe close your eyes if that helps you focus, and ask yourself, what is my ultimate hope? And I could use the meditation bell. Where is it living right now? Beck, thank you so much. So I'll invite the bell to open and close the silence, and I invite you to ponder that question. What is my ultimate hope? Now the second question, what do I want to embody in my own life? Decide what you hope for, says Margaret Bullitt Jonas, and then live inside that hope. Bereft after the unexpected death of her husband, United Methodist minister and visual artist Jan Richardson wrote The Cure for Sorrow, a book of blessings for times of grief. Among them is this blessing of hope. So may we know the hope that is not just for someday, but for this day. Here, now, in this moment, that opens to us. Hope not made of wishes, but of substance. Hope made of sinew and muscle and bone. Hope that has breath and a beating heart. Hope that will not keep quiet and be polite. Hope that knows how to holler when it is called for. Hope that knows how to sing when there seems little cause. Hope that raises us from the dead. Not someday, but this day. Every day. Again and again and again. Amen. And blessed be. And now, for our benediction, I invite you to put your hands over your heart in namaste. I bow to the divine in you. The words of Rainer Maria Rilke, quiet friend who has come so far. Feel how your breathing makes more space around you. Let this darkness be a bell tower and you the bell. As you ring, what batters you becomes your strength. Move back and forth into the change. What's it like, such intensity of pain? If the drink is bitter, turn yourself to wine. In this uncontainable night, be the mystery at the crossroads of your senses, the meaning discovered there. And if the world has ceased to hear you, say to the silent earth, I flow. To the rushing water, speak, I am. Let us keep this faith, beloveds, and pass it on. The service begins when the service ends. Bless your hearts. I love you. Amen. And blessed be.
Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. For your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Your divine, my divine. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. I will go. For your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Your divine, my divine.
Please visit ASCBoston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.